I found that fantastic. As I was doing some bug archaeology, I noticed that they've always been a problem. My hunch was that the security research community has become really, really vocal recently. But in all actuality, they've been working on stuff forever. And security bugs have been there since the beginning. So the good thing about having the open source project was people could just file the bugs themselves or fix it themselves, especially in the beginning where we had the people filing the bugs being the main contributors anyway. So that was convenient. And one thing about this is that these security bugs didn't come rolling in just the day after the release and then on. They came way, way, way earlier. So believe it or not, this bug reported in 1999, far before 2004, is way before the 1.0 release. So this is specifically a bug in Mozilla, not Netscape, not to be confused with that. And well, this was a fun way to add keystroke listener. So the benefit of being open source is that we get a lot of people catching things before the release, which is really convenient. That's not the perfect way to approach security, but it's pretty cool. So this is one of the oldest security bugs I found in Mozilla. It was definitely the most interesting old security bug. And this is, I think, bug 18,500-something. Nowadays, I think we're close to 600,000 bugs. Now, those aren't all security bugs, thank God, but someday we'll get there. So here's another example of a bug that was interesting from before the release. So this bug says that key events from scripts can execute menu commands. I just want to spend a little time looking at this and thinking about it, because imagine a web page that can use your menus. Say you navigate to the page, and it copies a bunch of stuff, and then navigates you away and pastes a bunch of stuff on another page, and maybe submits a form. This is awesome. And in fact, I can imagine a situation where this vulnerability would lead to history theft, so they know where I've been browsing. You know, the page opens your history list, it selects all, it copies, it closes the history list, it pastes it into the web page, and then submits the form. But this isn't the only way to steal history. In fact, it's not even the easiest way. CSS makes this incredibly easy. You can just check to see what color links are, and there you figured out what the history is. So this has been a problem since 2001, so since before Mozilla 1.0. And woe are we who have to implement both browsing history and CSS, right? We have to choose between showing people where they've been and protecting them from this. So what do? People like purple links. Anyway, this is a taste of a platform security problem that I'm going to talk about in a little bit, a web platform security problem. This becomes a lot more interesting today with really powerful computers and very robust and fast JavaScript engines. But let's think on that for a while and kind of shift gears a little bit. People are reporting bugs to us because it's an open source community, but how can we automatically find bugs? And to some of you, this is going to be old hat. We write fuzzers. So this is a particularly interesting fuzzer to me. In 2007, Jesse Ruderman released this at Black Hat. And this is, I think, to date, the only fuzzer we've released. But this is cool. So what this does is this creates random JavaScript. Knowing how the JavaScript engine works, it creates random JavaScript and kind of pushes the envelope, tries to break the rules, and then tries to crash our JavaScript engine. And the question was, when we released it, how effective was it? So here's the tracking bug. These are all the bugs that it's discovered. Not all of those are security bugs, most of them. It's found 1,020, well, not most of them, lots of them. It's found 1,024 bugs since August 2006. And in the first year, it identified 280 security bugs, which is pretty significant. And this is really useful, especially for those cases where our debug builds are running the unit tests, and then when we ship the software, it's in an optimized build, and we don't fully test them or get enough information out of them because there's no debugging information. When we fuzz the bits that are shipped instead of the bits that are tested heavily, we get different results, and sometimes we get some unique crashes that are unique to the versions we ship. And you know, to date, there are over, I think there's now 1,025 bugs found by this fuzzer. But when this was released at Black Hat, the first thing was this guy was a little scared. Now, he's a little dark on that screen, I don't know. For those of you who can't recognize him, this is Brendan Eich. He's the JavaScript guy at Mozilla, and he was a little worried about exactly this, fuzzing the binaries that we ship versus the ones that we test heavily. So this kind of moved us towards testing both our debug builds and our regular builds, but also fuzzing both the debug builds and the regular builds, because there is a wealth of bugs in there, and he knows that we haven't fixed them all yet. So publicly releasing this fuzzer was hair-raising, because we're releasing a tool that people can use to attack us, and that's kind of scary. But you know, at Mozilla, we're all about transparency and sets of eyeballs looking at what we do and our source code. So that's one thing we believe not only is a core value, but it's a benefit to our security. We have a lot of people looking at stuff. We don't just have the people that we employ trying to attack our software with access to our code. We have probably over 10,000 people who have looked at the source, and a good portion of those are worried about security, and they're worried about not crashing. And not crashing is usually a good sign that you've eliminated some of the security problems. Anyway, so we still have this today, even though this was an experiment in the beginning in Mozilla. And our community is so large that all these eyeballs are really helpful. And we ended up growing up. So today's a little different. What do we do today? This is what we used to do. We still focus on security, right? So November 9th, 2004, this comes out. And this time we were really happy because we spent a lot of time retooling, remaking things. We tested the crap out of this before it was released. And so, you know, the redesign, all the studies, all the testing, everybody's going to love this, right? Yeah, except for this guy. So a couple of days before the release, this IE fan, I'm not just calling him an IE fan because they dislike Firefox, they actually are a self-described IE fan. They say Firefox is ugly and sucks. Well, let me give you some more details. It says, you can't release Firefox like that. Just see how ugly it looks like. Horrible. You need to improve Firefox. And, you know, this is the form we give people to fill out when they file a bug. You know, reproducible always. Go to spread Firefox, download Firefox, note ugliness. Expected results, stay with Firefox. So not everybody liked it. And, you know, we got feedback from a lot of people, and things have changed since then. But, you know, this was filed shortly before the 1.0 release, when everything in the UI had been frozen for a long time. But not everybody disliked it, right? We have about 400 million users today, we estimate, and many contributors, which is really important. So that brings me to a different way that researchers can contribute to us. We pay for really good bugs. If a researcher finds a bug in any of our stuff that's security critical, and we have a short description of it on our website, what security critical means, then we're willing to pay for it. So it became really hot when there was more contention in the browser market, not just us and IE. And researchers are really paying attention to this bounty program now, less so than they were in the past, but it's always been pretty successful. This was conceived about the same time as the Mozilla project, and the original idea was to pay researchers $500. So thanks, this is a really serious bug, researcher. We're going to CC you on our bug. You can help us fix it if you want. We'd like your insight, and here's $500 and a T-shirt. You know, T-shirts are more popular than the money, go figure. So in the last 6 years, greater than 80 researchers have reported more than 110 critical security bugs that qualified for bug bounties. So these are only the most severe bugs. These are the ones that could zero day us if they were released in the wild and deployed as an exploit. And I don't know, some mafia came and botted everybody through Firefox. So we don't like these bugs very much, and that's why we pay specifically for these. The same researchers reported way more security bugs that were less severe, but these are the numbers we have because we kept track of how many people we paid. So we grew out of that, right? Security research is even hotter now. The swarms of press at Black Hat and DEF CON are a good indicator that people are really interested in vulnerabilities and reporting vulnerabilities. And there have been campaigns by various people like Charlie Miller where they want to be paid for bugs. And it's fair. It's hard work finding bugs in, especially security bugs, in products. And then there's also the black market to consider, right? So there are people who will spend a lot of money to buy a vulnerability to use it for what we consider evil. We can't really compete with that because they pay very well. And so our goal is really only to sit on the fence, and if somebody is wondering whether or not they should give it to us or to the black market, should they help the attackers or should they help good old Mozilla, we like to try and push them over the edge to help us. And that's what we're hoping to do with the Bug Bounty Program. So we recently revamped the program so it's more than $500, because $500 is fairly paltry nowadays. And in a lot of the places where people live, the people who are reporting these bugs, $3,000 is a big deal. It's enough to pay the rent for a few months, and so it's enough to support them. And if they have to make a decision between paying the black market and or getting paid by the black market and living fairly well, or getting paid by us and living okay, now it's less of a problem because $500 may only last a couple of weeks. Additionally, we want to recognize researchers who want money for this and who want recognition for this. And what a better way to recognize somebody than to send them a check with their name on it that says Mozilla. In fact, a few of our early bug bounty winners, if you want to call them that, claimants, they never cashed the checks. I don't know if it's because they didn't want a money trail or if they wanted to frame the check and hang it in their living room. I have no idea. So aside from that, it's clear that this is a fairly good idea because other companies are picking up on the whole bug bounty thing. Google's release recently, you know, when they released Chrome, they have had the bug bounty. And also, they've recently revamped their program to pay a little bit more as well, and we think it's kind of the sweet spot of paying right now. And we'll have to consider it again in the future. But the main idea here is researchers who want to get paid a little bit for contributing really hard work should get paid for that. Now, I've spent a lot of time talking about this, but bugs don't just come from manual tinkering. Like I mentioned before, fuzzing. So we fuzz more than just JavaScript now. We fuzz pretty much everything in the browser internally. I think our couple of people who work on fuzzing are finding roughly a third of our critical security bugs, at least the ones that we know about, the ones that are reported and filed. So this is great, and I'm not going to talk a whole lot about fuzzing because if you want to learn about how good fuzzing is for finding bugs, then there's thousands of papers out there for it. So That's fine and dandy. We find bugs, but how do we work to keep the software secure? How do we work to keep websites secure? This is different. So nowadays, people seem to be thinking more about having the browser, which is traditionally called a user agent, as their protector, right? So this is the image a lot of people have of their browser. So it's supposed to protect you on the web, not only show you websites and help you interact with them and send all your data to Facebook or MySpace or whatever you use. But they want the browser to protect them from bad sites. They want the browser to protect them from crashes. We want to give people flexibility to have that. So we have to build a browser that can act as a protector for them. So let's see what kind of things we do to do this. So we have a safe platform. In this example, Bruce's safe platform happens to be some belt and braces that he's wearing. We make the components in the browser safe. We use wrappers for proxying communication between different bits of the browser. So in the case of like the same origin checks that we have to do, we catch any objects that are created in JavaScript, wrap them to make sure that they're more or less sandboxed when they try and interact with parts of the browser or other parts of the web page. And there's various other wrappers we have because we have different kind of levels of access in the browser. So these are kind of an architectural safeguard in case a malicious site tries some sneaky tricks. This is one of our levels of defense, is to stop them during the communication. So these are basically the boards around the sandboxes. Like I said before, the same origin policies enforced via these. But then there's also stuff that we implement in the browser to help protect our users. that we haven't completely built ourselves. For example, safe browsing, right? I'm not going to talk a whole lot about this, but the basic idea is Google provides a wonderful service for us to check to see if a site a user is visiting is known to host malware or is a phishing site, and this is indispensable. But then we also don't write everything in the browser, right? There's add-ons that people can author to change the way the browser works, and these are incredibly popular. I've heard that about 50% of our users are thought to be using add-ons of some sort. Now, they don't all use the same add-ons because there's tens of thousands of different add-ons. And we don't know about all the add-ons that are being used. But we have to think about them when we're considering the security of our platform because they're basically part of us. The way that add-ons are currently implemented is very heavyweight. More or less, an add-on in Firefox can do whatever Firefox can do. And so these architectural safeguards that I was talking about before are incredibly important because they also help protect bits of the add-on from bits of the browser and vice versa. So there are some add-ons that actually do help improve security themselves. For example, NoScript, Better Privacy, Cert Patrol. These are all things that people install because they want more security in specific ways that maybe the general public doesn't want. And so it's nice to be able to support these. These are, as I said, these are basically part of the browser, and they're really heavyweight, and they're tied in very tightly to the browser to the point where it's like that chainsaw attached to Bruce's hand, or where his hand used to be. If they go down, they can take the browser down, much like plugins, right? So if I go to a website that has Flash on it, and it crashes, that could take the browser down. So we have to be very careful about that as well. We recently respun the way we do plugins in Firefox, on Windows especially, to put plugins like Flash and Java out of the process. Now, these aren't to be confused with the add-ons I was talking about, like NoScript, that add functionality. These are the special third-party binaries that add a block of something to a website. So we move these out of process because we noticed that a lot of the time Flash or Java was causing Firefox to crash because of a bug or because of some very malicious denial of service attack that was being mounted on that plugin. So if we isolate them in a different process and it crashes, we have the ability to recover gracefully for the plugin, just restart it. But the browser doesn't have to do anything. You can just say, okay, sorry, plugin's gone. You lose that bit of data. So how does this work? Well, here's an obligatory data flow diagram, right? This is a technical conference, so there's a few things I have to do in this talk. One of them is to show you how data flows. If you don't take anything else away from this, there's two processes. There is inter-process communication, and when one of the processes crashes, the other one gets to stay. So why would you do this? Well, I told you at one point, a major source of our crashes was Flash. So here's what it looks like. Say you're hanging out playing, I don't know, this farm game where you've got a wonderful farm going on. You're tending to your apple trees, maybe picking your corn, and then all of a sudden, oh, it goes down. No longer does the whole browser go away, but now you see this, and if you reload the page, it comes back. Hey, that's pretty cool. Really, plugins are a separate program, and it's about time that we treat them as a separate program. So this is kind of a good step in the right direction. So you can do this in Windows in 3.6.8 and later, and in 4.0 we're going to move it to Mac and probably some other platforms if we can get them finished. So this has made my browsing experience way better. Firefox has quit crashing on me since this. Chrome's been doing this since it was released, so this problem, I haven't encountered this problem in Chrome. All right, so I've been talking about the browser as a safe platform, and we're kind of getting closer to the web platform. We're getting into the web page bits. So what can we do to help sites' security improve? We've been working on a lot of different web security features. So these are features that are intended to prevent or stop things like cross-site scripting, cross-site request forgery, DNS rebinding, clickjacking. There's a big laundry list of these that I really don't want to get into. Each one of these is an hour and a half themselves. Debatably, these are flaws in a website. Some of them are in the browser. Or are they in the website? Like, should cross-site scripting be the responsibility of the website to protect themselves against? Or should it be the responsibility of the browser to protect the sites from it? It's not really clear, because there's only so much a site can do, and there's only so much a browser can do. So maybe in an ideal world, we can cooperate so both the site and the browser can work together to figure out whether or not an attack is going on, and if it is, stop it. So some of the stuff we're working on is content security policy, which does exactly this. This allows a website to specify normal behavior as far as what gets loaded on the site and how scripts can run. And then the browser, getting this policy, enforces it. So your website could say, hey, I trust content from YouTube, but I don't trust content from anywhere else on the web. And when your site is rendered, if it tries to load content from anywhere else on the web, it'll be stopped. The benefit of this is an attacker can't come to the website, inject a script tag that's persistently stored into your website, and then when visitors come along and that script tag loads, the script content gets loaded from their site. That gets blocked in the case of a good content security policy. And that's not the only problem, though. I mean, there's been exploits in image decoders and video decoders. And content security policy allows you to, when you trust just specific sites or specific domains, reduce your attack surface to just those specific sites or those specific domains. So if you host something like a blog where comments can have images in them, you can control where the images come from or block them outright. Now, this is something sites opt into if they want, and we think that's important as well. We don't want to, you know, put our own policy on all websites unless it's going to help all websites. Additionally, we're catching up with X-frame options. This is a way for a site to stop from being clickjacked. It can say, hey, I don't want to be framed, or hey, I can be framed by myself. This is something that's been discussed quite a bit, but we're doing this as well. Now, content security policy also provides X-frame options-like stuff, but it's a heavier weight kind of policy mechanism, more than just a switch that says, hey, frame me or don't frame me. So it's not for everybody. We're also working on strict transport security, which is formerly known as Force TLS, which is formerly known as Force HTTPS, so that sites can say, I want to be accessed over HTTPS and then never get accessed over HTTP anymore. This helps minimize man-in-the-middle risk. And there's a lot of other features that we're thinking about implementing but haven't really spent a whole lot of time engineering yet. So let's go back to this old friend, cascading style sheets history sniffing. I was talking about this before. This has been around for a long time. I've known about it since 2001. People have known about it since before then. So it's been a problem since CSS. The CSS2 spec even says, hey, this is a problem, so browsers might do funny things here. So what should we do? So one of the things that we're implementing in Firefox 4 that you can play with now if you want, and Safari is implemented already, which is awesome, is mostly a countermeasure for this. It's three steps. The first thing we do is we lie to web pages that are using JavaScript to ask what color links are. So you've got blue links that are unvisited, and you've got purple links that are visited. Well, when the web page queries it via JavaScript, it always looks blue. It always looks unvisited. This way, you can prevent some of the really fast attacks that render 400,000 links on a web page and then just queries them quickly using a web worker in JavaScript or something like that. So all links look unvisited to JavaScript, but when we render it in the browser, they're rendered properly because we have special privileges, right? You know, hey, we're the browser. Second thing we're going to do is restrict style changes so they can't reshape the page or change the layout. So a visited link can't be bigger or smaller than an unvisited link. It can't be invisible versus an unvisited link that's visible. It can't have significant differences. The kerning can't even change. So this is meant to protect against those style sheet attacks that look to see where the link gets rendered or where the bottom of the page is or how the layout has been affected by the rendering of the links. This is another kind of clever way to figure out where you've been. It's just check how big's the page. And then the third thing we're doing is we're pre-computing both the visited and unvisited styles for all links and then just using them as appropriate. So hopefully this will minimize the number of timing attacks that can be mounted against this, but surely there's got to be some timing attacks that are left. So our goal with this kind of path of turning off this really, really, really old problem is we're going to reduce about 10% of the functionality of visited links. But we're going to gain 90% of privacy, right? We're going to gain a big win in privacy. A website won't be able to just check where I've been. They have to explicitly ask me to copy and paste my history or find another, you know, exploit that can copy and paste my history. So this is awesome. We're seeing it implemented in multiple browsers now, so it's about time, right? But this isn't the only privacy issue that's been facing us, right? We have trust issues. Getting a good UI to people about the trustworthiness of their site is very difficult. EV is one of these efforts to say, you know, hey, by the way, this site is more trustworthy. Now, whether or not it's been deployed effectively is still a question. Do people notice that, hey, your URL bar is green? Ooh, that's cool. What about colorblind people? But then there's also the question of, does paying $400 to get an EV certificate really gain your users a whole lot? And why do you have to pay $400 to be identified properly? So we're working towards making not only a UI that's more reflective to users about what we know about a site, affirmatively know about the site, and so this is constantly evolving. Our current iteration looks somewhat like this. We know that this is paypal.com because the CA's checked that out for us. But there's a lot more we can do. And then, you know, privacy is a big area. And this is kind of the new hotness right now. Everybody's talking about it. There's articles and newspapers about it. And there's a lot of complaints about cookies and tracking right now. So we're talking about what we can do to help people control their data better. One thing is, you know, we provide blocking of third-party cookies. We block third-party cookies as they're being set and as they're being transmitted. So if you go to a site and they set a cookie for their site, and you go to a third-party site that embeds the first site's cookies, then we can block that. And we can also block the case where you go to a site and an iframe from a different domain sets a cookie. We don't have it turned on by default, because our impression is this would break a large portion of the web. But we're exploring other things. I'm going to talk about that in the future section. We have a private browsing mode, where if you saw the talk, it's not perfect. Now, we've implemented it as a local attacker solution so that if my wife sits down at the computer, she won't easily be able to figure out through the UI where I've been. Local attackers are getting more and more savvy. They're finding scripts that can look to see where I've been. They're installing spyware for their kids to see where their kids have been. So maybe we need to reevaluate the threat model. Maybe the local attacker is not the only problem, too. So we're also moving out of just doing Firefox, right? We have a lot of different things we're doing. We have a sync product now that lets you push all your bookmarks and passwords and things into the cloud and then get them back later from a different browser. Privacy was really important when we designed this. In fact, it was so important that we don't even want access to that data. We want to serve it to you, but we don't want to access it. So we made sure that all the encryption gets done on the client, and when you ship the stuff to us, we don't know your passphrase for your key, so we can't decrypt your content. So that's kind of one of the major things that we're doing in the privacy area right now, but we're also looking at some more stuff. So that's what's going on right now in Mozilla land. And surely it's not representative of what everybody's doing because we're a very fairly small group compared to everybody. But let me talk about what I think is on the horizon, especially things that we're working on at Mozilla. We have concrete plans for Firefox 4. I told you some of the security and privacy stuff that we're going to do for that. So I'm going to focus on things that we're actively trying to solve that we think we may have a good solution for, but we don't have a planned implementation of. And then I'm going to also talk about some things we have no clue about that maybe you guys are in a better spot to figure out than we are. But first, let's examine where we're going with the browser. Because what we need to do is sync up what we do with security with what we do with everything else. Otherwise, the security, if it doesn't match up, may not work properly. So web apps are becoming incredibly rich, right, with HTML5 and related shiny features. The browser is starting to manage full-bore applications and not just web pages and wikis. They're essentially becoming OSs, right? Maybe this is because OSs aren't allowed to become browsers, at least, you know, as Microsoft realized. So we're excited to announce that we're going to be implementing... No, I'm kidding. Okay, not really implementing Firefox OS. But this really seems kind of where it's going, right? Here's a list of features that are new in the last year, right? Holy crap. That's a lot of stuff. And we're getting closer to the hardware of your computer. And in fact, this evolution has not been slow. And this is worrisome from a security standpoint, because each one of these is an increased attack surface. And if I was enumerating all of the new features in the last year and putting them side by side to all the new features for the last 10 years, I think the last year was pretty huge. So this is the second part of giving a talk at a technical conference. I have to show you a chart. This isn't really empirical data, but it's a chart nonetheless. So it's clear that web apps are wanting to do more and more with your computer. And they're getting closer to using all of the abilities of your computer. In fact, they're getting so close, you know, I'm projecting that websites are going to start adding abilities to your computer soon. But this kind of shows you a timeline of what's happening and what's driving it. eBay is way back, you know, in 95, right? So things like eBay are old features. YouTube came about just before 2006, and that started kind of pushing the use of video on the web. And that's driven us to implement things like open video. So you can have video directly in the browser without a plugin, which is an alternative to using a plugin. Let's see. So we have more robust docs, apps like Google Docs that use pretty much every bit of JavaScript that it exists. And then, you know, we get to the point where people are writing full-fledged Nintendo emulators that run in your browser. And once we add 3D support, who's saying that you can't have a full-fledged Xbox emulator in your browser? This is becoming a big deal, and there's a lot of attack surface that we need to think about. So maybe we need to start approaching protecting websites as first-class apps and not just as these archives of data. So let's go back to the browser as the protector model. Here's this guy again. So remember the add-ons. Well, they don't all need to be fully privileged like the rest of Firefox. One of the woes we have with add-ons is that if an add-on does something malicious, there's nothing we can do to stop it. It has all of the privileges as a full-fledged application. Maybe that's not such a good idea. So we need a lighter weight solution for things like his watch or his shotgun, the things that he just picks up and uses that aren't an integral part of what he's actually doing. So we're working on an alternative architecture called Jetpack. Some of you may have heard of this. We've been pushing it a lot. Right now, it's deployed experimentally, and the goal is kind of twofold. We want to add some security, and we want to also make it easier for developers to rapidly develop cool add-ons. My hunch is that about 90% of the add-ons hosted at add-ons.mozilla.org would be happily implemented in this. Surely all of those add-ons that check the weather and show it to you in a widget can be implemented in, you know, 10 lines of code in Jetpack. But in order to do it in a full-fledged add-on, you have to write hundreds of lines of code, and you have to do all sorts of crazy XPCOM calls. So the idea here is we want to have an API that add-on developers can use, and then they can write just a JavaScript module that does all the work. So even more interesting is limiting them to JavaScript isn't really limiting. It's more empowering if we provide a good API that says, hey, you can do this. You can do this and this and this. Right now, the idea is read our code to figure out what you can do. And I don't think that's a really good solution. Now, from the security side, we can also tag each add-on with capabilities and then enforce that. If we have complete control over the API, we have the ability to say, this add-on is requesting access to paypal.com. Would you like to allow it? Or when you install it, it has a list of things it's going to do. It's going to access the network, it wants your geolocation, and it's going to take screenshots. I don't know why, but those are maybe some things it wants to do. Then when it's running in the browser, we have an opportunity to enforce it. We have this contract. This may sound familiar to some of you. This is done in other places as well. And this is another instance of declarative security, kind of like that content security policy stuff I was talking about before. The program should declare up front, a summary of what it wants to do, and then if it breaks outside that summary, something might be wrong. So kind of similar to this, we're exploring multiprocess architecture. We think the Chrome browser got it right. Isolating different bits of the browser into different processes is a wonderful idea. We took the first step by putting add-ons in their own process, or not add-ons, I'm sorry, plugins in their own process. So when Flash goes down, your browser doesn't go down. But what if JavaScript locks up on me? Can I restart the web page without restarting the browser? These are things that, like I said, Chrome did right, and we'd like to do something similar. We have a project called Electrolysis working on this, and it's a little bit harder to do this with a very old code base than one we've just ramped up. So another thing we're working on is called Account Manager, and this is just a concept right now, but the idea is websites can interact directly with the browser through some API to help make it easier and safer or a consistent experience for users to log in, to register, to do different account maintenance things. If the browser can act as a proxy for you, it is your user agent after all, if it can act as a proxy for you, it can generate good passwords and remember them for you. So maybe you log into the browser, conceptually, and then the browser remembers all your passwords for you. If you want to sign up for a site, the site can tell the browser, hey, you can sign up for me, here's how, and the browser can represent it in the UI parts instead of in the web page. And this gives users a more consistent experience across sites. So when they want to figure out how to register for a site, maybe they could just click sign up right next to the name of the website. That'd be pretty cool. I'd like that. So if we implement something like this, where you can interact with the account maintenance parts of the site through the browser instead of through the web page, we have some more information at our fingertips that we can use to keep people safe. For instance, we know if you've already registered at a site, so we can tell you if the site is trying to spoof another one because you haven't registered at it. If it looks similar and you know the domain name is similar or images are similar to another site, we have an opportunity to say, hey, this might be a phishing site. You've registered for this other site that claims to have the same name, but you haven't registered for this one. So you might be a little bit leery. Additionally, we have the ability to promote good passwords that users may not have to directly remember, but can use like a keychain for. We can auto-generate passwords for websites for them here. And then with sync, they can take them with them. And there's the password recovery problem. You know, what if I'm at a browser and I don't have access to my Firefox that can log me in? What do I do? So this is something we're still working on. But the consistent experience for logging in, logging out, signing up, I think this is a good win for authentication. And I talked about how we were working on better trust. I'd like better trust. Obviously, where we've gone with EV isn't good enough. There's got to be something we can do more. And we're thinking about what other cues we can give users to tell them what types of information they've given a site or what types of information the site has about them. This isn't just SSL information. For example, there's no reason we can't tell a user directly how frequently they've been to a site. So if they go to a site, maybe we can give them a confidence that this is really the site that you meant to go to, if they've been to it a lot in the past. If I go to paypal.com and you know I accidentally type paypal.com or something, if it looks the same as PayPal and it has a certificate, even if it's an EV certificate, I'd like to know how many times I've been there if I frequent the real PayPal site. So this is just one example of better trust. Maybe we can give users a little more information about who the site is. We're researching this, and I know a lot of you are as well. This would be cool to have better trust. And then privacy, right? This was the new hotness I was talking about. There's a lot we can do to improve users' privacy on the web. This is kind of a twofold problem. The first problem is users voluntarily disclose information to websites. That in itself isn't a problem, but users aren't maybe sure what the website is going to do with that information they disclosed, or maybe it's misleading, or maybe over time, the website changes their mind and decides to do something else with it. This is something that if we can help out with that, it would be awesome. We're exploring doing some privacy icon work where the site tells the browser what it plans to do, or maybe a reputation system tells the browser what this site will do with your information. And then hopefully trying to distill it down into some sort of visual indicators for the user so that the user has an idea without reading the 400-page privacy policy of what the site plans to do with their data. This is very experimental. We'd love your input on this kind of stuff. Additionally, we're exploring things like fingerprinting and how to shut down some of that or reduce the entropy emitted by a browser. There's a lot of data in the user agent that we transmit. Now, that there are other browsers that transmit more data in their user agent than we do, but it's still an awful lot. Based on our user agent header, you can tell on what day and at what time the browser was compiled. And why do we need this? So there's a lot of other indicators that are sent out when HTTP requests are transmitted, and we have to explore whether or not these are necessary, absolutely necessary. So we're looking at this and trying to figure out how much of this we can turn off that's not useful, because some of it's been around for 10 years and maybe it's not used anymore because we have these new shiny features that can be used instead. Additionally, cookies are a problem, right? People complain about cookies all the time, super cookies. It's one of these new terms that I've heard batted around recently about cookies that are not really cookies, but they do the same thing. We're exploring different ways to approach cookies, and in particular, third-party cookies. What if third-party cookies weren't simply, there's a third-party site, we don't care what site you're on, but when you transmit cookies to the third-party site, they're considered third-party unless they have the outer frame of being the original site. What if we double-key them? What if a cookie is tied not only to the domain that it's being sent to, but also the domain of the page, the root page, that it's being triggered by? So if I go to Mozilla.com and we have an iframe that happens to show a YouTube video or something like that, or maybe it's not an iframe, maybe it's just third-party content. When that's loaded from YouTube.com, the cookies are sent to YouTube as third-party cookies. And if I've authorized third-party cookies, which may be useful on some sites, they always go out, no matter who's embedding YouTube.com. But if I only want to trust YouTube when it's embedded on Mozilla.com, I have no way to do this right now, aside from an add-on that lets me specify this. If we double-key them so that the cookies are tied to both YouTube and Mozilla, then maybe this relationship makes a little bit more sense. Again, you know, hey, we're not implementing this yet because we need to think about it. We need to figure out if this is usable and if it's going to destroy the entire ecosystem of the web, which is a bad idea. Additionally, I told you a little bit about our synchronization stuff we're doing. We encrypt the data before we send it to the server, so we, as the server, have no access to your data, and anybody who asks us for your data additionally has no access to your data, unless they have, you know, the quick shortcut to break RSA, like dream inside a dream inside a dream. But we also have this issue of people wanting to share their bookmarks with other users. So what do we do there? And maybe this is a job for fancy crypto. I don't think we employ any cryptographers. So this is something we need to think about. So there's a lot more open questions that we're not actively exploring that I'm just going to throw out there because I think they're important. I have three slides now that say just privacy on them. Obviously, I think this is important. I talked about our explorations into visual representations to users about what's actually happening. Reputation systems in this area would be useful if deployed sufficiently, you know. We also should reevaluate private browsing, right? Are we doing the right thing? Should we be doing something else? How useful is private browsing mode as it is? It's surely not standardized. All the browsers do slightly different things. So we need to rethink this and maybe come up with better use cases, more broad use cases that this mode can address and be more useful. Also, you know, we've got these fingerprinting things like Panopticlick out there that takes bits of information from the browser and then says how unique you are. Maybe we should start thinking about how to provide users a little bit more anonymity that they used to have before the web, I guess. Can we actually provide this as a browser? Can we, without reducing or destroying the features on the web, can we actually give users a feel of anonymity? The Tor and Tor button projects have taken a good step in this direction, and I think we can learn a lot from what they've done and figure out if this can be useful to more people than just use Tor and Tor button. Additionally, how much anonymity can we provide short of using an onion routing system like Tor or using an anonymity mix network or something like that? Can we actually do enough anonymizing in the browser to make it useful? That's a question that I have absolutely no idea, but I would love to know, because people are saying, I want to browse on the web and be anonymous, but I don't want to use Tor. Well, can we do it? That's a good question. And then, you know, once again, I want betterest trust or bestestest trust. We can do better than even the stuff we're working on right now. We need to step back and how do we represent the identity of a site to a user in a way that they understand, in a way they can trust, in a way they can verify. Sure, as security experts, there are ways that we can represent identity to ourselves, but my mom doesn't know what green or blue or what any of this certificate stuff means. She doesn't even really look at HTTPS in the URL. I ask her if she's at a secure site, and she says, I think so. It's my bank. I think we can do better here. I'm not a UI expert. I know there are people who are very well poised to help us solve this problem. And then finally, aside from all the technical problems, there's socio-technical problems. Now, these are the things like phishing that involve some sort of deception or psychology. We can't just write a patch to the browser to fix phishing. We can write a patch to the browser that uses a reputation system to decide whether or not the site you're on is phishing, but we can't stop phishing, right? We can't stop spam for the same reason. So there are a lot of problems like this, negotiation between sites of who the sites really are, representation to you. You know, a site puts a logo on their page. That may be good enough, especially as browsers are getting low profile and kind of out of your way so you can just use the web page. A logo on the page may be good enough to convince you that, hey, this is your bank, even though it's really not. So what do we do here? There are trust issues in the way PKI and SSL is implemented, right? So we have a lot of CAs, and they're all trusted equally. Maybe we can do something better. This is an area of research that I think needs a lot of attention, because as the web evolves and we have more technologies, sure, we can throw engineering effort and research at fixing these technologies so they're secure, but when psychology enters into it, I think it's a bigger problem entirely, and we can't just engineer our way out of that. So anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you. Be happy to take questions at the mic.
Is it on? Yeah, okay. So we'll open it up for questions. I guess I'll start. Let's see, I had two questions. One, I was kind of curious about your position, Mozilla's position on native client, and if that's ever going to ship, or when and how and if. And the second one was for Google Sync. It's the data is encrypted on the browser. If I understand correctly, it's encrypted with a password. Do you think you're going to get, I'm just curious, what's going to happen when law enforcement realizes that there's a lot of data now on your servers? You could be subpoenaed. You could be required to run a password cracker. You could be required to provide backdoors to that data. How's this all going to play out?
All right. So, great. The first question, I don't know enough about Mozilla's poise on native client to give you an answer to that right now. So I'm going to disappoint you on that one. The second question is a good one. I assume you said Google Sync. I assume you mean Firefox Sync. Okay. Because I know Google has a Sync product as well. I'm not completely familiar with how that works on the back end. So yeah, there's issues with compelling information from us. And one of our motivations for encrypting it on the client and never having access to the secrets that encrypt your data was that we don't want to be asked for your data. And if we get put into a situation where we have to start wiretapping, this is going to make me really uncomfortable. We don't see your data now, so a wiretap is going to see encrypted data. And if we get compelled to force your password out of you, it's going to be easier for the law enforcement agents to go directly to you and say, hey, here's your laptop, type in your password. Because we have no way to do it. And, well, we don't have the computing resources to decrypt RSA, at least not until I can figure out that inception trick.
We have heard about the history data that we all conclude that we cannot hide, and it's basically open, and it's a big issue. And nobody really has a clue how to go about. Now you said you want to store the passwords of all the accesses, and imagine that this is basically the same as history data. One or the other, you can get at these passwords. And also, if you change your browser, do you move them all to the other browsers, and they might not save them correctly, or how do you go about that?
Yeah, so exactly. The difference that I see between storing history in the browser and storing passwords in the browser is we don't make a web page look different based on whether or not you have a password for it. So the content, the JavaScript and the DOM and the CSS, they have no idea if you've stored a password. And if they do, it's a bug, file it, I want to fix it. Syncing passwords, it's a touchy thing. We can learn a lot from the way keychains have been developed over the years to figure out how to properly keep them secure. Aside from that, anything a user stores, like bookmarks in their browser, so as far as I can tell right now, websites can't figure out which sites you bookmarked, at least not in Firefox. Anything you store in the browser is a risk, but users are going to store stuff on their computer and in their browser anyway. If we make it easy, we can at least help out with the security. So.
Hi, Dave Crystal. You mentioned a sort of negotiation about privacy between a browser and a website. That is an old idea. There was P3P, which dates back to, late 90s, and it never really gained traction, I think because the cost of the websites to figure out exactly what their privacy policies were was kind of
immense,
hard. So do you have any ideas for making that a more promising approach?
I think one of the ideas that we're batting around is to remove the responsibility from the website to some other mechanism, a reputation system, or a think tank of lawyers who can translate privacy policies for us. In an ideal world, we'd have our little hamsters in a cage that spin the wheel, and out comes the icons from the privacy policy. We don't have a solution for this yet, and we're approaching it backwards and keeping P3P on our shoulder because we know that it didn't work out very well. And we're starting with what users can understand. And once we get there, the back end, the whole discussion of what does this site do with your data, what does the site say it does with your data, that's going to take a while to figure out. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that yet. Yeah.
Yeah, hello. Kasper Rasmussen, ETH. I have a question. It's not really a security question, I guess, but maybe you can comment anyway. There was this issue with video codecs that you guys didn't want to include the video codec for some of the semi-closed or closed formats, not even as add-ons or
you're talking plugins. About H.264.
The whole YouTube HTML5 thing. Is that a security problem, or is it, why don't you want to allow people to create add-ons for this, for instance?
All right, so I'm going to start with a disclaimer that I'm not a lawyer, and so I can't tell you our policy reasons or try and explain our policy reasons for why we don't want H.264 or why we're not going to implement it. What I can tell you is we're very excited about open standards that aren't locked down by any sort of patents or secret systems, and we want to encourage the use of those.
Flash is not really, Flash is also sort of semi-closed, right? So that argument is a good one, but it can't really be the truth, in my opinion.
Right.
Sorry to be a bit harsh, but it would really be a useful feature,
we do want to support open standards and new stuff. I'm not going to say we exclusively support them, but if we have another way that we see that is open, that is transparent, that is not encumbered by patents or IP, We would like to do it. And in the case of Open Video, we didn't have it implemented yet, and so we had options.
So there was this interesting study last year by Chris Hufnagel, a professor at UC Berkeley, that found that when users see the word privacy policy on a website, they think that means that the site protects their privacy. And this is made even more severe by the fact that most users actually don't read the privacy policy, right? So all they ever see is the word privacy policy on a site, and then they immediately think, aha, this site is protecting me. Mm-hmm. Now, that privacy policy may, in fact, say that we will collect your data and sell it to everyone on the planet for 5 cents, but most people won't understand that. Mm-hmm. Given what we know from that situation, I'm a little bit concerned about the use of the term private browsing by the browser vendors, given that they have a very, very narrow definition of the attack model, right? So it's basically a limited local attacker model that's not your IT department. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned that that isn't something that's being communicated to consumers who might read the words private browsing or incognito or stealth mode or whatever and see that and think that the feature is going to be delivering a lot more. So my question is, how do we solve this? And do we either deliver more or promise less?
Yeah, see, that's a really good question. that was one of my slides. See. Well, okay, so this one. I mean, I'm not cheating. My notes say private browsing. Yeah, that is a really good question. How do we match users' expectations to the brand or what we're doing? And that study is exemplary of two things. First of all, it shows the motivation for reflecting what a privacy policy means to users, not what it says, but what it means. And maybe we need an add-on that deletes the words privacy policy from a site entirely. And then we also need to reevaluate private browsing in general. The paper talk yesterday was fantastic in showing that, hey, private browsing isn't really used for buying wedding rings. But maybe we need to figure out what should we do? And the problem with just changing the name of it immediately is the people who used to have private browsing mode are, what do I do now? I don't know what this new mode's going to do. And we could advocate what it does the same way we did with private browsing mode, showing them the list of three things that it does or whatever. But it's not going to do any good as a different name. So I think we need to reevaluate how it works, who's going to use it, and once we understand that fully, do something different. Yeah, in the front here.
Thank you for your talk. Have you looked at sandboxing in a way where you can create not just, in other words, if you're banking online, you may want to strip a lot of possibilities out because basically you don't care. All you're looking at is numbers and very, very trivial, simplistic web experience. And then have a second or third or multiple tiered sandboxing environment where you can have all the thrill and the capabilities you want, but sort of create that. Have you looked at that from a security standpoint? Because I think that, at least in speaking to some security people, they will do sandboxing, strip anything that they can, and use the browser like it was in 1990s. Yeah. And it creates the security they're looking for. Mm-hmm. So have you looked at that? Thank you kindly for your presentation.
Sure. Thanks. So, I've thought about this a lot. And I think content security policy is a step kind of in that direction. This is the site saying what it wants to do. So if your bank wants to protect the users, it can say, hey, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, turn off the other bits of the browser that do things. Right now, it's restricted to content loading in JavaScript, but I could see a situation where we want to add in super features, like WebGL is disabled on this site kind of thing, where it shuts down bits of the browser. There have been, you could call it forks of Firefox that gut out bits of it that do exactly this. There have been forks of Firefox that gut out features and that do exactly this. If we do that, then we have a UI problem. How do we represent to users this restricted mode? This is the same as the private browsing problem. But I think with starting with the sites declaring what they want the browser to support for them, we can kind of extend that into a robust model that if users want, they could also declare that. I want to trust this site to do X, Y, and Z, turn off the other features that, aren't necessary. So eventually, I would like to see exactly what you're talking about, a rule set in my browser that if I'm comfortable doing this, I can say, when I'm on mybank.com, turn off all of the features except for images, text, CSS, and, maybe a little bit of JavaScript. So, yes, that's on the front of my mind. So, yes.
Paul Van Orschot. So I'm worried about your mother and people like her. So if we look at what we have, you know, websites with no certificates and self-signed certificates, although they're very hard to get through to those sites now, but if we're persistent, we can get through to them. Mm-hmm. And then we have regular certificates, and now we have EV certificates. And if we ask your mother what the difference is, what does she say?
She asked me what's a certificate. I mean, does this show that you completed a course?
Exactly.
That's exactly the problem. Yeah. And I don't know what the solution is. That's the bestest or better security.
That's exactly right. So we've gone from the regular certificates, which seem to not have met their original need, and we've done something better. We've made better certificates. And I guess I wonder whether we need to have a double EV squared certificate, or whether we really need to start thinking about if we have to move to a different point, a different framework.
So my personal impression is that. We need to really reevaluate what we're doing. I don't agree that EV is a better certificate. I agree that it's different. The purpose was different in the technical side, right? Yeah. But the users don't see it as different.
Right.
And so I consider that subpar, less than good. We'll put it that way. It's not a bad thing because we still have the technical win slightly. But the users are still, they're not very helpful. So I think, like you said, we should move to a different point and start thinking about what we can do to make this whole situation better. We can't abandon what we have because clearly it gives us a little bit, but we can get so much better. Yeah. Thanks.
Stuart Barclay, back to some of the sandboxing stuff.
Sure.
Where I see some of the issues are you're running an awful lot of things in one process space, one information space.
Exactly.
I use a few profiles, run completely different instances of Firefox, one for my company business, one for my banking, and I can set different policies on those, not as fine-grained as I'd like, but I can say my bank can save cookies mm-hmm. when I'm in my banking browser, but none of my other browsers can save cookies. Mm-hmm. Things like that, and the profiling has kind of vanished from the UI. You mm-hmm. can't get to it except from the command line, mm-hmm. as far as I've been able to find. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the about config or somewhere like that, there's some things you can twiddle. But I think actually running these, having the ability to run this stuff in multiple process spaces where things are really, other than the OS level, are really disjoint. Mm-hmm. Your bookmark files are different. Mm-hmm. The update time on your access time on your bookmarks mm-hmm. doesn't cross-contaminate across instances. So I think those are some areas where some going back to where things used to be, mm-hmm. 15 years ago might be an interesting thing to do.
Yeah, I completely agree. The multiple profiles is very useful. Recently, somebody filed a bug that said remove profile manager from Firefox. It almost made me cry because I do the same thing. I agree with your points. One of the things that we're batting around right now is logging into your browser. This comes from the browser is becoming, well, it's a side effect of the browser is becoming an OS, right? But you're right. If you log into your browser as one user, you can go to your bank, maybe log out, and it re-encrypts everything, and then you log in as a second user, and it's got your regular browsing session stuff. We need a better UI for the profile manager for sure, especially for those cases where you want to run in a safe mode and an unsafe mode or five different modes or something like that. I think we should support it. If you know of people who are willing to contribute to Firefox to help us implement that, I would be incredibly happy and I'm sure it wouldn't be resisted.
Thank you for a great talk and thank you also for your emphasis on the viewpoint of the user. I'm glad you're concerned with that.
Oh yeah.
And I'm a bit worried that it's difficult to solve the issue just by looking at the browser side. For example, in the case that we just discussed about the certificates, then the browser can do everything properly to show the certificate in a way that's understandable and so on and so on, and then it's defeated by a bank that has its greatest asset is the name of the bank, www.nameofthebank.com, and then serves its certificate from some other outsourced place for logging in. When you log in, you don't see that name. And then you see something that logically, I mean, if you understand the first bit, should be phishing because it doesn't come with the certificate of the name of the bank. Now, if they can't care about this, how can the user possibly, even if they understand HTTPS, do anything about it? And another case is that of the JavaScript, and you mentioned the NoScript extensions and all that stuff. And if I say to myself, not even to my mother, okay, I will disable the JavaScript unless it's something where it's obviously necessary to have JavaScript, such as, I don't know, Google Maps, I understand, could not work without JavaScript. How could it fetch the various places? But anything else, I mean, I'm just logging in for booking an airline ticket. Why does it need JavaScript? But still, if I leave it off, then I won't be able to buy my ticket. There's a kind of negotiation that I can't have because I can't talk to the site. And I said, look, I want you to work like you would have worked in 1995. I don't need anything more. But I can't argue with you.
Yes.
So providing the facility is all very well, but then I'm forced to turn it on even if I want to keep it off.
Right.
How should we deal with that? How can we enforce the sites to also do the right thing?
Yes, right. So those are some very good points. And I think forcing the sites is not something I can do. It's just like if you download a bad application on your computer and run it, you're going to get the same warnings no matter what EXE you download. But when you run it, it's going to do what it does. And if you downloaded a Trojan, you're going to become a bot on a bot network, right? So what I'd like to focus on is the cooperative sites, the sites that at least want to do the right thing or something that resembles the right thing. The declarative security model of content security policy is that. It's like, hey, I'm a site. I don't need everything to work. In fact, if it does, I may be owned by cross-site scripting. So here are the things that I expect to use. The capabilities model is provided there, and it says, hey, if anything else happens, then I probably got owned. Please help me protect the user. There's that. I think there might be a way, so this is just way off in left field, you know, the tomorrower approach. There might be a way to leverage some sort of reputation system for policies like that, that say, that aren't maybe dictated by the site, so it's not the site saying, I expect to do X, Y, and Z, anything else is weird, but a reputation system that says, this site is okay to do X, Y, and Z, let it do it. So it's kind of like a third party saying what should be safe on the site. But then, like you said initially, getting the users to have control is useless unless the UI tells them what's really going on. And with respect to privacy, we're revamping the way that we deal with cookie exceptions and loading images, blocking images, things like that, to be a little bit more accessible to the users so they can see what a site can do instead of what sites cookies can be set on, then open another preference pane, and you know what sites Flash can be run on and things like that. So the two steps are, one, provide some sort of declarative security that lets the sites say what they anticipate to do in good faith. Enforce that. And then also, we have to help the users tune the knobs themselves. I don't know how, but you're right. This is a major focus, and we're nothing without our users, so they're obviously the most important to us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah, Rick Farrow. Well, that does bring up some sore points, really. I'm very fond of NoScript because it does give me the option to enable, unfortunately, just for a site-wide basis, JavaScript, which I usually leave off as a default. But talk about one thing that I'd really like to see in a browser and actually, you know, editorialized about 8 years or so ago was to have a button on the in the Chrome that said, turn on Java, turn on JavaScript. So actually it would like start blinking at me and says, oh, this site wants to use JavaScript, you know, and that's where you'd bring in your reputation, sort of like other people who try this, you know, complained to us and said that it was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. So a UI that actually blinked at you and blinked green. Oh, well, turn on JavaScript. This site's considered trusted. That kind of a UI feature, I think, would be very helpful. I think that the only people I know that really care about things like this are the security geeks. You know, Dan Gear being an example of somebody who's extreme. I know other people who are using links still because they're so freaked out about this, and of course people constantly complain. Another bad example of dangerous thing is Flash. How many people have heard that there's another Flash vulnerability out just announced today?
Yesterday,
okay. So people know about that, okay. I missed it yesterday. I guess I wasn't looking at my email enough. But I don't have Flash. You know, I keep Flash on one computer at home, and that's the only computer, you know, I go, well, unfortunately for my wife, it's her computer. But not on my computer. So she sends me a movie and say, leave it on your computer. I'll come down and watch it. Because Flash is dangerous. I don't think it can be made unsafe. It'll be really interesting when the Adobe guy makes his talk today. I just want to be here for that. Certainly, I'm not clear. Have you figured out a way of running Flash in its own sandbox or in its own process?
Yes.
And you have. This is in 4, though, right?
So it's in 4 for Mac. On Windows, which is like our major client base, it's in 3.6.8.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already deployed to a lot of users, and we've noticed our crashes, which usually, you know, lead
yes,
to
right.
memory problems and exploits. Those are way down because while we get reports when Flash crashes, we can now separate them out very easily because it just gets restarted and user keeps going.
Sure. Well, if Flash is never going to be a vulnerability again, which obviously is not going to be the case. Having something that pops up. Of course, NoScript does this. It says, oh, Flash belongs here. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I wish NoScript would say Flash belongs here, and here's the alternate text. So things that make it easier for people to actually do good security rather than be painful. Mm-hmm. NoScript is unfortunately fairly painful. You know, it doesn't actually say, oh, there's scripting here. I would like to be able to actually say, oh, I need this widget. I'll only turn scripting on for this widget. That would be nice.
Yeah,
but
people need fine-grained control.
Fine-grained control, but something that's actually usable, like a little push button that says, yes, execute this.
They're butting heads right now. Fine-grained control versus usable control. Yeah, when users are inundated with a million checkboxes, they don't know which ones to check.
Right. No, I'm actually thinking of something that comes out in the DOM. So you actually see in place of the JavaScript, you have a box here, and the box in the box says, turn on JavaScript for this widget that's in this box. That would be, to me, the ideal. But that's just an ideal.
Cool.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Alex Malin, you've mentioned a couple times not wanting to break the internet.
And too much.
Too much. And I think it's generally nice to be polite. But I wonder if at Mozilla you've thought about using your user base as a kind of, pushing your weight around a little bit, maybe one or two things that you could do to change them.
Sure, yeah. So we have to weigh a number of things, right? If we decide to break the internet and it makes 90% of our users mad, there's no more Firefox, right? So there's that. I like the ability to work on making the web safer, and without users, I can't do that. At least not at Mozilla. So the other thing is we have to rationalize everything we do that is going to reduce features or change features on the web. So the risk of having history sniffing, CSS history sniffing, was too much for the benefit of that 10% of the feature that was allowing it. So this is one case where we decided, some websites are going to break. I think PHPBB broke, which is a big deal. And I think it broke in a way that users aren't going to say, I don't like Firefox because the internet sucks now. So that was acceptable. But in the case where we break something very obviously, Like if we decide not to support, let's say images, because there are too many vulnerabilities in our codec or decoders or something like that, it seems unreasonable to me that that's a good approach. So you know, there's risk analysis that takes place before we do anything like that. Personally, I'm trying to make some of the engineers a little edgier and willing to push it a little bit more for security and privacy wins, especially as privacy is becoming a bigger problem, or maybe not becoming a bigger problem, a higher profile problem. So I hope I can make you happy in the future.
So I'm curious about your updates. You look at Chrome and it is completely silent. You show up, oh, it's updated, cool. And Firefox is very loud. I usually have to click through a bunch of stuff and it's kind of a pain even though I have it set to the most automatic. Mm-hmm. Why is that? And are there, you think about making it easier?
Are we thinking about making it easier? Yes. So we're pushing out in Firefox 4 an auto-update system that will push non-major feature-changing fixes quietly. And so when you restart your browser, boom, the updates are installed. But for things that change the way you interact with the browser or you interact with the web, we want to give users the option of whether or not they want to adopt those changes. Security fixes, like bug fixes, we should just push out, right? But when we start adding things like open video, people may not want it. Or when we start adding things like hyper cookies, some theoretical new tracking device that can be used, people may not want it. And so we want to be able to give them the option and notify them when something's happening. This is another sort of a balancing act between making users happy because we don't pester them and then making users happy because we do pester them. So auto updates coming, yes.
I had one more question. With respect to the social technical stuff, one attack that we've seen on Facebook is sort of a self-XSS, where it says, hey, copy this JavaScript, paste it in. What do you think are good mitigations for that from browsers?
So one thing that we're working on, I just keep plugging CSP, I'm sorry. This is what I've been working on for a while. So is if you can disable JavaScript URIs on your website, which would be very cool, then that attack may not work, right? So we're trying to implement it so that if you have a content security policy that says no JavaScript URIs, copy-paste into the URL bar of a JavaScript URI should fail. That's one option. Another option is to just get rid of the JavaScript URI, but that's too useful. There's a lot of people that use it, so we can't. And then there's the bookmarklets issue. So it's a very complex issue, but I don't see a clear path to fix it globally.
In the past, there's a lot of work that developers have to put in to make their websites work on the different browsers. And so, you know, you're sort of exploring new ideas, but you also have to keep in mind that it's a lot of work for developers to have to develop solutions that specifically work just with Firefox. So how much work do you guys put into sort of maintaining yourselves as part of the browser community where all of you are agreeing on things that sort of, you know, everyone thinks is a good idea? I know the frame-busting option.
Sure, right,
in the headers seemed like something which is an idea that everyone's converging on. Mm-hmm. But what about other ideas?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I can answer this in two parts. The first part is, personally, I spend a lot of time making sure what we do is compatible with other browsers, or if somebody wants to implement a new feature in Firefox, that it doesn't make the site abysmal in other browsers. Like, content security policy is just completely ignored in other browsers. So there's no security win, but there's no drawbacks. The site still works. As an organization, we spend an awful lot of time working with standards, trying to converge with other browser entities on pretty much everything. Our mission is basically to make a good, free, and open web, right? So the idea is we don't want to just do something that gives us the leg up on everybody else. We want to make it globally better. So it's in our advantage to do standards. If we don't think it's a good idea, however, I'm not saying that we're going to implement it just because it's a standard. But everything we do implement, we try to standardize so that everybody has the opportunity to understand how it works, and hopefully it will get deployed across all the different platforms. So we spend a lot of time working on that. All right. Oh, another question.
Just a quick question. You mentioned the content script policy or security policies a few times. Are those whitelists or blacklists or an arbitrary combination as defined by the server?
The way we've implemented it, whitelists. If you'd like more details, I can point you to the spec. But basically, it says these things are allowed. Everything else is blocked. Yeah. So, all right. Thanks a lot, everybody.